Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Oh, so good. Unbelievable. 720 WGN. I'm John Landecker with Fanny. That would be Jean Millington, her sister June, and also documentary filmmaker Bobby Joe Hart. Good evening and welcome is one of the first things I'm saying.
Hello.
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 Oh, you know, okay, I'm squirming, I got to tell you. I've been looking forward to this so much, and I want to thank you guys for being flexible about coming on with the schedules that we've been mixing up at the Stanley Cup. But listen, I want to establish my Fanny cred for 15 seconds, okay? Back in the days of when Charity Ball was a hit, I was a young disc jockey and a music director of a radio station in Philadelphia. And I was blown away by your album and the song, and we played it. And then we were going to put on a concert, and it was going to be a promotion, a free concert. And we gave away every ticket in the house to, I don't know, 13,000 people. And we had
13,000, really?
Yes, we had three acts on the bill. The Guess Who, Jose Feliciano, and Fanny.
I remember that.
Do you really?
Yeah, because I wrote to my dad about it. I saw a letter that I wrote him recently, in which I actually mentioned that concert.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Well, you know what? I think I probably have to apologize for being one of those idiot disc jockeys who asked the question, gee, what's it like being a girl playing a guitar, or some ridiculous stupid question that you were at. Now, I'm not sure I said that. So, you know, I'm just covering my bases, if you will.
All right, so what's your 2021 question to ask now? You're the evolved radio.
Yes, yes.
Come on, what now? I'm putting you on the spot. This is Bobby Joe. Putting you on the spot. What do you have to ask June and Jean now that's like the kick-ass question?
The kick-ass question. Wow. Well, that, you know, that does put me on the spot.
They deserve a kick-ass question because they're kick-ass musicians.
Oh, I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt about that. It's just, what's the kick-ass question?
You've got a lot of questions. Which one is your problem?
I guess, because I'm having trouble, like, where the hell do I start this, and where am I going, and how am I going to end it? Okay, here it is. Where did you learn to play such vicious guitars, and where did you learn to play such vicious rock and roll riffs that are as good as any rock guitar on the planet, rock guitarist on the planet Earth ever?
I would say number one was just learning them off the radio, off of records, and watching people like Jimi Hendrix. And really paying attention, you know?
Yeah.
And then when we got our record deal and moved to L.A., then I started to meet and jam with people like Lowell George, like Skunk Baxter, like, you know, Elliot Randall, heavyweights who were creating the guitar sound and the guitar licks that we now call, get ready, classic rock.
Exactly.
So the thing that they really impressed upon me, to tell you the truth, that really gave me the most room to move and to feel good about myself is to let go trying to learn how to play like somebody else or play their licks, let's say Eric Clapton, you know. Just let go of all that and play what it was that I heard, that
right.
I felt, which
right.
meant that I had permission to slow down. Because I like guitar lines that you can sing along with.
Right.
And so, therefore, by definition, they got to be slower.
Well, you know, the line is, Fanny, the first female rock band to sign to a major record label and actually put out a record. Which I played the hell out of in Philadelphia, and which is why I'm sort of nervous about this whole thing right now, to be honest with you. And there's a documentary called Fanny, The Right to Rock. There's an album, Fanny Walked the Earth. And there's a story that has to do with things that we're very familiar with in our society, and that is sexism, racism, homophobia, just a whole laundry list of things that you guys faced that were, how do I put this, maybe even more powerful then than they are now, because they seem to be more recognized as things that should not, that people shouldn't have to deal with. Of course, I'm not saying that there aren't things in our society that aren't like that. I mean, there's national news almost every week about something like that. But at the time, you know, you wrote lyrics that had to do with the birth control pill. And in a time when people really didn't want to hear that from anyone, let alone a female rock band, which just shows to show you how incredibly ahead of your time you were. And it's about time that time catches up with you, and you catch up with time, if you ask me. The documentary is fantastic. I'm going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and I'd like you guys to tell the story of coming to America and being Filipino and coming into Los Angeles and the kid with the Mustang and all this other stuff that you had to face initially. We'll be right back with Fanny on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, that's Fanny back in the day doing Charity Ball, and I've got Fanny tonight on the phone, and June Millington from the band, and Bobby Joe Hart, who is the director of a really fabulous documentary called Fanny, The Right to Rock. And I also want to recommend the album Fanny Walk the Earth, which I bought, and just proves your musicianship is extraordinary. So can we talk about the beginnings of you coming to the United States and what that was like in L.A.?
Well, actually, we moved to Sacramento, and I'll let Jean take that question.
Well, we moved from the Philippines when I was 12, and June was 13. Actually, we had been playing ukulele and guitars in the Philippines before we even came over here. You know, we were playing like Yellow Bird, different songs that learned from the radio. And then when we came over, that the music was one way for us to feel like we were somebody, you know, like in junior high.
Right.
When we played for the what do you call it, June? The
variety show.
The variety
junior high variety show, right?
Yeah, the variety show. And then after we did that, was when people started talking to us in the halls, and we go, oh my gosh, we're now, people are noticing who we are. And so we started out like that, playing guitar with them, and singing with two other girls. So the four was playing the same guitar stuff and singing together. And then from that, that was when the folk songs and folk singing was coming in. So then we started totally getting into all that kind of music. And then the Beatles hit, and then the Beach Boys. So we started wanting to do that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
So June, you can take it from there.
Well, you know, we wanted to play what we heard on the radio because it totally galvanized us. And as I recall, the first song that completely grabbed us with a different sound, a different energy that just jumped out at you from your little transistor radio was, believe it or not, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? Sang by the Shirelles and written by Jerry Goffin and Kara King. So, you know, that kind of gives you a glimpse into the very bare beginnings. We had never fallen for anything like that because nothing ever reached out of the radio and just grabbed us like that, you know? So, of course, we started to learn those types of songs off the radio. So we went from Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow to Motown to Be My Baby, you know, to the Beach Boys. I mean, gosh, those harmonies and the Beatles. So it was a really exciting time in music. Plus, We were just graduating from high school, and the Vietnam War was escalating. Now, you can't give me a better sort of concoction to have music really represent what we were thinking and feeling, and what with Jimmy coming out with, you know, Let Me Stand Next to Your Fire, and,
right,
you know, just a ton of stuff that made you move. But then you also had the young blood singing, come on, people now, smile on it, brother. I mean, you know, I mean, these songs were really thematic and emblematic for our age and what we felt like we should be singing and thinking about. The only thing I regret is that I wasn't able to look at any soldiers returning from Vietnam in the eye. You know, we'd see them in the airports, and I regret that I couldn't quite look at them and, you know, thank them for their service, which right, they certainly did. But other than that, it was a great time for music, and man, we just love so much great music, and you jump over into every genre, you know, and there were great songs everywhere you looked, or you didn't even have to look. They were just in the air.
Well, the thing about your...
And you guys were self-taught musicians.
Yes.
I mean, that's phenomenally important to mention, that you were self-taught, and, you know, I mean, I just find that freaking amazing.
Well, we were a self-taught band as well, not just individual musicians, but
and
we had to learn how to be a band. Yeah.
Well, especially when you hear... Well, the result of yourself, your teaching, it's just astounding. And
yeah, it really is.
No, I mean, truly, I don't mean that in any kind of facetious way whatsoever.
No,
I mean,
not at all.
It's
receiving it that way.
It's rocking to, I mean, it's, you guys, it's like, this was not the Shirelles. This was not Motown. This was not the Beach Boys. This was not the Beatles. This was not the Rolling Stones. This was something completely different. This was... You know, musicianship, lyrics, stage presence, you know, you had it all. And
well, you know, it's a good thing that we didn't go to school to learn that which we were learning on stage and in rehearsals, because what taught us that we were doing a good job and that we were learning the right things and doing the right things was when people rushed to the dance floor.
Yeah.
That's when we got an A+. Quite frankly, you know. And there I was. I wasn't even playing lead there. I was just playing rhythm. Jean would be more like playing lead because she was totally jamming it on bass.
Yes.
Which is lead an octave down. You know?
Yeah. I mean, totally jamming it is an understatement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. She had her own style. She established her own style. She totally pushed the band from the bottom, I got to tell you.
You know, I'm going to...
Jean, you can comment on that, but I know it's true.
I'm going to skip through a whole bunch of stuff here. Let's get to the troubadour. So you come across, you know, now we're in Los Angeles, you know, the world famous troubadour. It is happens to be open mic night because, as you say in the documentary, there'd be no way that the troubadour would hire a female band on its own. But since it was open night, open mic night, you got to go on and play. And then what happened?
Jean, take it.
Yeah, well, we played, I think, about 15 minutes and then we left the stage. And people just were clamoring for us, so we went back on. So we did more songs, and people were blown away. And then a woman named Norma Goldstein, who was Richard Perry's secretary, happened to be in the audience that night. Richard had asked her to come hear us. And
he had heard that we were playing there, so he said, why don't you go down and check out whatever's happening?
Yeah, whatever that is.
Yeah, I wish they didn't know.
So she reported back to him, you have to come hear this girls. I think it was the next day that he got us to go to the Wally Hyder studio. Well, we set up our equipment and auditioned for Richard. It's supposed to be about a half hour. We were there a couple hours at least. He got so excited to know us and to have the band. And so it went on from there. He went on to really push getting the record deal from Warner Brothers.
Yeah, and then starts what you would almost call, at least from my vantage point, a sort of a stereotypical California, Southern California lifestyle, rock and roll. You get this house that used to be Hedy Lamarr's, and you called it Fanny Hill, and everybody's living there. I mean, this is just like the hippie thing.
Only part that's not really stereotypical is how hard we worked, and I mean every day. So you could think of us as a rock band at Fannie Hill, but you can also think of it as, you know, a rock and roll marine base.
Absolutely.
Because we got up and did 100 push-ups, you know, musical push-ups, and we were at it.
But there were other people coming in and out, like Joe Cocker.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing... It's an amazing story. I mean, how cool is that to be in a, you know, this is, you go to the Troubadour, you get, you look at the guys there, Richard Perry's there, you're going to get the record label, we get the house, Joe Cocker's coming over, everybody's coming over, in and out, Bonnie Raitt, the whole thing. It's like, wow, I wish I was there.
Well, you couldn't just come. You had to know somebody, you know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
So we were a little bit more protected than that, but all those people really, really did get in.
I know,
they found somebody who knew somebody who... You know, they got in, and once they got in, they didn't want to leave because we really could play, and they could jam with us, you know. And I realized that even with John Lennon, and I met him last when he was working with Earl Flick on the last album. But even when we met Ringo and John and Paul in London, you know, the thing that they were the most wanting to get next to, you know, with regards to us, not as chicks or as,
you know,
was the fact that we could play.
Yes,
they
that's the point.
They were completely freaked out at that, and they knew we could play because, hey, we did Hey Bulldog, come on.
Oh, I know what you did. I know what you did. I'm going to play some of the stuff that you did because one of the things that you did just blew me away. And I'm like, what am I, 22 years old or something at the time? I'm like, what is this?
What is this?
Yes, this is great. Yeah. We're going to do more with, hold on, guys. We're going to do more with Fannie when we come back after the news break here at 720 WGN. Oh, it started over again. How about it? How about it? I told you I had some tunes.
You got Fannie, all right.
You know, I'm telling you, I had that album, and I hit that cut, and I'm like, they are doing Cream. This is unfriggin' believable. And I mean, it was awesome.
Big ass cover.
And you know, like, I'm like,
yeah, but don't forget, I was playing through a Leslie as well. I had a dual switch, so I could turn on that Leslie, and I also could change the speed of how fast it was turning. So that was part of my awesome sound.
I'm just telling you that this band had such credibility with the musician community. Okay? It's not like here's a... I don't even want to go down that road.
No,
it's just they were... Fannie is and was, you know, first and foremost, great vocals and unbelievable musicianship. And when the other major rock stars of that era heard what they could do, they gave them credibility. And so we get to this label and we get signed, da 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 da. And then you go to the United Kingdom on a tour that lasted how long? I mean, you were in the documentary. It seems like this was it was two things. It was great, yet it was exhausting.
Well, I mean, that first tour of England did take us over also a little bit into Europe, but we were also simultaneously recording our album with Jeff Emmerich at Apple. So I think we arrived there right at the beginning of December, and we left at the end of December, so we were really there just maybe a month, and we did an awful lot of work. So, you know, when I say that we worked every single day, every single minute, hour, not just at Fannie Hill, it was also on the road. So, you know, having done all that work, I look back on it now, and I think to myself, how did we do that? You know, because we weren't counting them. And by the way, Harry Nilsson was hanging out there with us every day. We know we had a lot of fun aside from working, but we got the job done, you know, and that was in a month. We had to get back to L.A. because Fannie was playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go over New Year's, and we usually did like two or three evenings for New Year's, which, you know, drove everybody crazy. They just loved it. They'd come back, you know, night after night.
Now, the one thing that's missing from this story so far is in my opinion, the songs were hits, but we're talking about having a big, gigantic hit record. And that is part of the equation that seemed to be missing. And over time, you know, this takes its toll on your relationship with the record company, your belief in the career path that you've decided to follow, and it's and what happens to the band is what happens to a lot of bands. There was some infighting, if that's maybe a too strong a term, but some disagreements, if you will. And then you have the ridiculous record label putting you in these unbelievably stupid outfits that they thought would help generate, I don't know, let's make them sexy or something, which just goes to show you that they didn't get it.
No, they did not get it. This is June. And one thing I want to say for sure so everybody understands is, yes, there was infighting, but that's not why I left the band. I mean, one can say I broke up the band because I left first.
Oh, no.
But let me just finish my statement. The reason I left was that I knew I couldn't grow as an authentic human being. Now, I know that sounds a little bit, you know, I don't know, that she dropped some dope or something like that. But it's really, you know, that question came from my heart, and I knew that the answer was I couldn't get that in L.A.
Yeah.
You know, L.A. is not built for basically interpersonal growth or intrapersonal growth.
No doubt.
So it scared me because I wanted so much to learn, and I knew I wasn't going to get it there, so what could I do? And I talked it over with Jean. And she saw the state I was in, and she agreed that I did have to leave, but I made my promise to her and to the band that I wouldn't leave until we found my replacement, which was Patty Quatro. So it all, you know, it worked out quite well. And Jean, with the band with Patty Quatro, got the hit Butter Boy, which was, you know, the one that went, what, the 31 or something? Jean, it was the highest.
Butter
29.
Boy. Yeah. Well, let me tell you something about...
29, there you go.
Let me tell you about...
June, before you left the band, it's important... This is Bobby Joe. It's important that the audience know as well that you, before you left, I mean, you had four critically acclaimed albums, then plus the fifth album after you left, which has the Butter Boy hit on it as well.
Right.
Like, you had been kicking ass and writing songs and making albums and touring, you know, across North America and across Europe, and simultaneously releasing four critically acclaimed albums, getting the likes of, you know, Joe Cocker, Bob Dylan's The Band, Bonnie Raitt, David Bowie. I mean, you had put out your hearts and souls, whereas when other bands were doing the same thing, they would get the hit. And so mm-hmm. it's important to qualify how much material you had put out that was effing amazing before even that fifth album came out and when you left. I just wanted to qualify that.
Well, there's something I'd like to throw into this mix.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. All right. I'm going to tell you something else about this, why there wasn't a bigger hit. Okay. So I said that I was back in Philadelphia and Charity Ball and all that. Then I got a job offer and I came here to Chicago and I got on a really big AM rock and roll station. And that station was so picky about what songs it would add to its list. You weren't going to have a hit in the Midwest unless you were on this radio station. And when you have a song come out and the first line is something along the lines of, he was hard as a rock and I was ready to roll, my program director probably crapped in his pants. So, you know, and he would not add, you know, wouldn't add the song because it was too much for him. I'm guessing because I lost touch. You know what I mean? I'm like, what happened to Fanny? And then when I'm watching this documentary and I see this thing about Butterball, I'm like, well, there you go. You know, they just didn't make the, as many bands didn't get added to this playlist. That's why they called it Top 40. There was like 40 songs, but in actuality, there was less than that. And if you didn't get in that mix, you know, you weren't going to get the kind of exposure and then have that hit record. So, you know, it was a format.
It was kind of a rigged game. Let's
yes.
put it that way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I just wanted to add the radio aspect to this story as to why songs that should have been mass appeal hits never really got to the point where people were able to hear it. You know what I'm saying?
That's just too much prejudice.
Yeah. And
honestly, it's just prejudice. Simple you know, stir, shake, add some more prejudice.
Yeah.
And you got the result that we had in Fannie, which we were really tired. You know, if we had had a hit, per se, we would have, it would have put a spring in our step, let's say.
Certainly.
And so, we could have lasted together longer, and who knows how much longer, but definitely longer. So it was just so discouraging to realize that the weight of society, not just record stations, mm-hmm. but society was so, they didn't even really think of it like that, you know, like, I don't want to like an all-girl band, but that's how it turned out.
Yes.
You know? And so it was just prejudice, and it broke my heart. I know, and I'm quite sure it broke the other girls' hearts too. Because you know, we were tired, and we were just so good. I mean, how much did we actually have to do?
Exactly. And here, but wait.
Gene, how did it feel writing that kind of song? I mean, because he just said. I mean, I really appreciate also that you just said I would have loved to have interviewed you for the film, but it's so great to have this to hear you saying this. As someone who's been in radio for so many years and saying you were so believed in the band and their songs, and you were realizing that even stations you were working for weren't giving the radio play to that song. Like, Gene, how does that make you feel to hear that after you wrote that hit song?
Well, the thing is, I didn't think about the lyrics were too racy or whatever to be unacceptable. But that song was actually a great commercial, I think. So I don't really understand why it didn't quite make it in the past 39. It was so disappointing for all of us. So we, like June said, we worked so hard all the time. We were writing all the time. We were rehearsing in our rooms on the road all the time. We were doing sound checks, and we were performing as much as we could. You know, so it was so hard for us that we'd never got a hit song. I guess we weren't pop-oriented like the Go-Go's.
Well, you know, it's deeper than that, and it really actually isn't something that was aimed specifically at you. Trying to get a hit record, trying to get a song on one of these radio stations for anybody was a nightmare. And it was just such a very narrow playlist that getting in there at all was a major accomplishment. I mean,
let me give you this. If it had been guys, a guy band who did as many great covers as we did, the four albums with as many great, original songs, they would have had a hit. There's no doubt about it. It was just too good. The material was too good.
You ever heard of You ever heard of the band Styx?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
they're from Chicago. You have no idea how long it took Styx to get on the friggin' radio here because they were so conservative about what music they would add. I mean, you have no idea. We're going to take a break. We got to talk about what's going on now. We're going to leave the past behind, and we're going to get to the present when we come back with Fanny on 720 WGN. This could go on, at least as far as I'm concerned, for a long time. But let's talk about now. What's Fanny doing now?
Well, basically, we're celebrating the release of Bobby Joe's movie and looking to talk about it and move on it as much as possible. I mean, that whole thing's just started through the festival circuit. So, I think it's going to take people a while to catch up to it, but that's what's really happening.
It's called Fanny the Right to Rock. So there's no way it's not streaming anywhere at this point or in theaters at this point, but it's on a festival circuit.
Yeah, it's on the festival circuit. It just started across Canada, across the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And then, we have a lot of different distribution companies that are interested that we're speaking with, including Magnolia.
Oh, yeah.
And where the theatrical release across the U.S. will probably happen in the fall, or probably in November.
Great.
And, there's a lot of streaming possibility offers that are coming in as well. But we really want to do the festival circuit, and we really want to have Fanny at as many live in-person festival opportunities as possible with the public, because they deserve that. I mean, after all this time, they deserve to be in person, to be experiencing the audience, experiencing the film and the reactions. And also, we have a campaign that is inspired by the sticker of Fanny in the 70s that is in the film, in the trailer, Get Behind Fanny.
Mm-hmm.
And Get Behind Fanny, for me as a filmmaker, is my goal, my humble goal, but not so humble, is that they deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, last year the Go-Go's documentary came out, and they're a phenomenal band, and they were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, just like Todd Rundgren. And both of them are in the film and talking about how important Fanny is in terms of a legacy. And Todd Rundgren produced one of their albums. And Kathy Valentine talked so positively about Fanny and standing on their shoulders, metaphorically speaking.
Yes.
And so really the film, like what Fanny's doing, like it's time for the public to discover their music. Whoever hasn't discovered it, discover the music. The film is just a catalyst for everyone to discover their music, to get behind Fanny, to get behind them. And let's do what David Bowie said in the film, revivify Fanny, and he will feel that their work is done.
Yeah.
And to me, that includes getting them in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2022.
Well, there's also the album, Fanny Walked the Earth, which is which is an awesome, awesome collection of tunes that has amazing musicianship on it that'll blow anybody away if they would take the time and get it. That's on Amazon and some other places because I found it looking for it, and it's just even more incredible than that it was in the beginning, at least in my opinion. And you know, whatever it takes to get you guys the coverage, the acknowledgement, the, you know, into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, I don't know if I can help it anyway, but if there is anything you want me to do down the line, don't hesitate to call, because I've been into Fanny ever since the, you know, the beginning. And it was such a thrill for me to know that there was, first of all, a new LP, and the documentary is, you know, I was fortunate enough to get a screener, and it is amazing. And my wife is like, wow, these guys are fantastic. I said, yeah. What do you think I'm talking about here? Yeah, they are unbelievable. And I don't think that just by me saying so that people are going to say, somebody might say, he's hyping them because, you know, he's on the air, he's got a show, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah? Well, take a look at the movie when you can, and then get the album, and then you tell me. Because it's...
What do you think about this, Gene and June? What do you think is important that people know?
Gene,
that as a band, the documentary speaks of how great a band we were,
yes,
how important we were,
yep.
And you know, I want that recognition now, you know, and also Fanny Walked the Earth. We made that album in our late 60s. For heaven's sake, how many women kick butt like that?
Exactly,
in the late 60s?
Exactly.
So I would like that album to get out there and sell.
Yeah, so would I. I mean, you'd never know. You know, I bumped, we call it a bump. I did the
So you should be playing all that Fanny Walk the Earth music on your radio station. Play all the songs on that album this week. That's how you can help.
Well, here's the deal,
play
though.
Play those songs and give them the link to where to buy and stream that music. That's how you can help, baby.
We have a little problem in that department. This is a talk station. It's not a music station. So we don't have music licensing here. And we can only get away with playing a minute of anything before we cross over into copyright infringement. So that's not going to happen, but playing the entire album is not going to happen. But I've been using, you know, cuts that last maybe 40 seconds or so.
So how can you promote people to stream and buy the music on this show right now?
I tell them to. Go stream and buy the music.
So, Gene and June, where can people stream and buy this music right now?
I mean, so far as I know, everywhere.
Yeah.
Anywhere that music is happening, you can get.
It's on Apple.
All our Fanny albums, actually, you know.
It's
from the first four to the one with Gene's hit to Fanny Walk the Earth, which is essentially the sixth album.
Right. Well, listen, I have to end this, unfortunately. I wish all of you the absolute best, all the success that you deserve. I hope you get the hits out of the new album, the success of the documentary, getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Thank you so much for coming on. I hope I didn't ruin your day, whatever the term I'm looking for.